This is an interview with Professor James McClure and Paul Daldy for the University of Adelaide History Project on the 26th of May 2010, interviewer Rob Lynn. Well, I wonder if I could ask you both, gentlemen, what the situation was with this North Terrace campus when you first arrived.
Yeah, well, I got here in 2002, and the North Terrace campus, like the other campuses, had a lot of beautiful old buildings, one or two, I think it's probably one, you know, maybe two, modern buildings. But the old buildings, although they were much admired, had just been left to deteriorate, and they were in an extremely rundown state, and that applied to pretty much all of them, whether it was the Bonython Hall, the Elder Hall, the Mitchell Building that we're sitting in here, or indeed the laboratories, which are in historic buildings, and which had reached a stage where they really weren't effective teaching facilities anymore. And I have no idea why, well no, I do have an idea why, that was allowed to happen. I think it was simply a case of trying to avoid spending money on what was routine maintenance and could be deferred till the next year, and once you start deferring it, you just keep deferring it, and then it snowballs and you end up with buildings that are in a seriously rundown state.
It appears from the work that we've done is that there's virtually a hiatus of 30 years from the early to mid-70s without any major development work being done on the campus.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah, look, and I think you can trace that back to demographic factors as well, around particularly student growth over the various waves of reform in the higher education system. So when I look at the campus, I can see almost like the rings of a tree. You can actually do a cross section and see that you've got the sandstone buildings, which were the early manifestation of university at a time when there was 40,000, 50,000 people in South Australia. So quite an amazing level of investment. Then you've got the red brick buildings around which follow the river course in that sort of half circle, and that's really in the sort of between the wars era, and then post-war and the baby boomers coming through, finally coming to university around the 70s, you see an expansion, late 60s, early 70s, you see an expansion of the building stock in the middle of the campus. And I think unfortunately at that time some of the building standards were not up to what we would think is acceptable today.
Yeah, I don't think it was a heroic period of architecture and the building standards. I mean, the thing was built to the absolute minimum building standards.
Yeah, and I think it actually paralleled some changes in engineering and architecture as well, where there was a period where a lot of the sort of over-engineering was being questioned, and there'd been a scarcity of resource as well post-war, and there'd been a response to that in terms of minimising the resources put into buildings. And so when the Vice-Chancellor and I look at which buildings we'd actually like to
knock over and start again,
it's actually in that period.
Exactly, it's that middle period.
The most recent buildings, putting aside the lower level site development and the ones we've done recently, are the ones where you say, well, they're just not of a standard that meets what we're looking for.
But I think it's the perfect advertisement for not building to minimum standards. Whenever you're building in something like a university, if you're building a commercial building and you're prepared to knock it over in 25 years and build another one, that's fine. But when you're building in a university, you're building for the future. You're building buildings that you want to be here in 100 years. And then in 100 years' time, people are saying, that's a very old, nice building, so we won't touch it, and so it'll be here in 200 years. And if that's what you're trying to do, and it's what you should be trying to do in a university, then you shouldn't be building to minimum standards. And they look as though they've been built to minimum standards. They haven't had the sort of services put in you'd expect. They start to fall apart after 25 years. And so you've got all those problems. And then it's compounded by the fact we've got the 70s buildings, 60s, 70s buildings falling apart. And then the older buildings that haven't been maintained. And so the whole infrastructure just sort of got into decline.
Yeah, and I think as resources became tight, also some of the features that you expect of a university building and a, I suppose, a public space were also compromised. So, you know, you had corridors that were narrower, ceilings that were lower, spaces that were previously departmental common rooms being taken over for offices, some of the student spaces that were that you'd expect were taken over for, I suppose, more logistical functions. Yeah. Like,
and I guess
teaching,
it was a financial issue.
Yeah.
I mean, every corner that could be cut was cut.
Yeah.
And it was done often with the best of intentions. The intentions often were to make sure that the maximum amount of money was committed to, say, the research enterprise was the university. And so the university had this great, proud research record, but it was being conducted in facilities that were increasingly fragile and not fit for purpose. And so you face this rather unfortunate situation where you sustaining that research effort was becoming increasingly impossible given the state of the facilities it was being done in.
Yeah, I think, can I just add, the other thing was, I think at the same time as there being, as there was a growth in student numbers with the baby boomers, obviously there's a growth in staff numbers too, and you can see that in our age profile of our staff. And so there were facilities that were built, and I think a good example might be the Napier building, where by and large the staff sort of grew up in that building. And so and I think the maths building is another great example, where
the old maths
building, where the staff had been in the building for so long that they didn't notice that it was actually dysfunctional, didn't notice that it hadn't been maintained. And so when new vice chancellor comes in, or new vice president of services, and they, I was a student here in the 80s in economics in the Napier building, and walking around it, I was horrified that we really hadn't invested in the teaching spaces, we hadn't invested in the public spaces, the toilets were smelly, not working, the air conditioning didn't work, the heating didn't work. And so
some might argue that happened from the outset of that building.
Possibly, but
I think it's quite possible.
But
it was built to cheap standard.
But the Vice Chancellor and I have been really a tag team on the revitalisation of the campus over the last 8 years, and I think the Napier refurbishment was our first big project, which was in those days a terribly expensive project. I think it was $9.5 million.
It was, and we really only got it going with the sort of threat that the Commonwealth Universities were about to descend for one of their major conferences.
Yeah.
The first thing I did, literally the day after I was offered the job here, and started work here, but offered the job here, I flew from the interview here to a meeting of the Council of the Commonwealth Universities, and I missed the first half of it. When I got there, they were discussing where they should hold their next planned meeting, and I said, well, they hadn't had one in the Southern Hemisphere for a long time. I said, why don't you come to Adelaide? And they said, oh, it's a good idea, we'll come to Adelaide. So we had like 300 Commonwealth Vice Chancellors descending on the place, and here we were in a state of not very good repair. And we needed facilities that they could be hosted in, that they could have their lectures and things in. And so that was the stimulus, where we said, look, there's the deadline. These facilities have to be up to speed before we expose ourselves to the view of the whole of the Commonwealth. And so we got it done. But as Paul says, that was seen as a sort of a
that
massive investment.
That was horrifically expensive at the time. Yeah. But now, we've just finished the $100 million engineering building, and people are talking about $500 million football stadiums, and it's quite a thing.
Yeah.
But I think the Napier was...
people were horrified whenever we said we were going to spend whatever it was, $9 million on that project.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing about that, it was actually on the teaching spaces, it was on the corridors, it was on the
toilets.
The toilets, and it was a holistic project. And I think prior to that, we'd had a very piecemeal approach of, office by office, room by room.
Something fell off, you patched it up.
So we took a whole building and said, we need to renew this. And I think the other project that, I don't know if you want to touch on, James, is you often tell the story when you first came to the university of the fence on North Terrace, and how we were essentially turning our backs on North Terrace, and we were enclosed behind the Gothic fence, and the lack of signage as well.
I mean, as Paul says, the first day I was here, I said, how do I find the Mitchell building? How do I find the university? I'd never been to Adelaide. They said, just walk along North Terrace, you can't miss it. Well, I got to the Botanic Gardens, and I thought I must have missed it, and I had. And the reason was it was literally closed off to the city. It had big wall, big iron fence, no signage. I walked past it without the faintest idea what it was. And looking back on it, it's horrifying. We now take for granted that people out in Pulteney Street look in at the Bonython Hall and there it is sitting there in all its glory. But it's not very long ago, there was a fence across there and big iron gates right in front of it. And I think that's been one of the huge changes in the Goodman Crescent area. You know, it was like something left over from... It was a kind of an area that kind of got left over and sort of turned into a car park with old poplar trees that were starting to fall down. It was just absolutely characteristic of the fact that, as you say, there was a kind of a 30-year gap where nothing had happened. And so we just set about changing.
So that, I think that was, that was a project that was about doing a couple of things. One was we were obviously responding to the North Terrace redevelopment. And if you've ever done any renovations on your own home, you know that if you do your bathroom up, suddenly your lounge looks lousy, right? So we were conscious that we didn't want to end up looking like an unfinished part of the... But we wanted to go one step further and actually create a public space that could be on standard, if not better standard, than the whole redevelopment.
Actually, I should have added, but I said that there had been a hiatus here. The Dawkins Commission through the 90s had actually meant that the Kirwan Building and the building on the corner of Pulteney Street and North Terrace had been added to the university, but not strictly speaking within...
No.
The original campus.
No, and so it's only literally in the last year that the campus maps have actually formally included 10 Pulteney Street and the other buildings. But I think that, just to finish the North Terrace, that was a project which was about regaining some pride in the campus as well. And when you talk about executive decision making, you know, buildings and public spaces just didn't feature. But as soon as the North Terrace was done, Napier showed what could be done. Lecturers started lecturing in modern facilities with modern audiovisual.
And they all wanted them.
Yeah, we've now created a challenge for ourselves, which is what we wanted to, which was we actually had some momentum behind the reforms as opposed to us just pushing.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So was that type of change to the Napier seen as a radical move at the time? You mentioned
well, to close it out from teaching for 12 months.
Yeah. It was enormously controversial. Yeah, the fact that it was blocked out from teaching, people couldn't access it, this was outrageous. And the cost of it was seen as, you know, beyond the pale. How could you possibly justify spending that amount of money? I said, well, you know, this is prime teaching. I mean, that's one of our principal teaching areas in the university. Now, when students go into it, it has a light, modern feel to it. It's got seats in it that are comfortable to sit in. You can see it's got modern facilities and all the teaching rooms, but it was seen as almost a waste of money. You know, what's wrong with a chalkboard and, you know, a few wooden chairs?
But also, I think it showed that you can do that. You can actually look at even buildings that aren't perhaps as well loved as some other buildings, like the Napier Building. Mm-hmm. You can look at them anew and say, well, there are actually architectural features in that building.
Yeah.
You know, it was of its day quite advanced, and you know there were
that's true.
You know, there were so the architects that did the internals really responded to the the good aspects of the,
because the basic structure of that building is solid, and it's designed of an era when the floor plates are big and open, so it's actually very usable space inside. Just hadn't been kitted out into a half-decent standard. But once the architects got in there and had a look at it, they said, yeah, we can make this into something that is still reflective of the era when it was built, but is beautifully functional.
Well, that being the first point of departure from what had been into a different era, what were the plans then to move into the present and then go forward?
I think the plans were to make sure, I mean, there were two competing things going on here. One was the university was growing rapidly, has been growing rapidly, and we talk about one extra high school a year as a rule of thumb, but you're looking at, you know, 500, 600, 700, 800 extra students every year, more than you had last year, and that just keeps accumulating. So you have the problem of making sure you've got enough facilities to stay ahead of that particular issue, or at least to stay up with it. And the other is to rejuvenate what you've got, to actually take what you've got and make it into a modern, usable set of facilities. And I think those were the kind of challenges that were sitting there. And so every decision we've made has been a kind of a balance between trying to cope with both those things concurrently, while at the same time, I mean, you've got a huge research engine that has been growing again at an enormous pace, and trying to meet the needs of those people for state-of-the-art facilities.
I think what we said was the next wave of development after that really needed to be justified on a sound business case. The university was still coming out of a period when it had some difficulties financially, and our finance committee and our council were justifiably concerned that we were doing the right thing. And so we built the next wave of development really on the back of the growth in student numbers, and they were primarily in the professions faculty and the engineering faculty at the time. So I said to you before that we had, I think, inherited a very much sort of almost room by room approach to change.
Yeah.
Then to start looking at whole buildings, we then started looking at whole precincts and whole faculties, and that then enabled us to really think about the space between buildings as well as what goes on in the buildings. And we had some very interesting discussions with, was it Jan Gehl, the Danish architect,
yeah,
who was a thinker in residence, really sort of came at a really good time for us to sort of make us focus on the space between as much as the space within. And so
his comments were very interesting, you know, just talking about the nature of the campus, you know, sitting alongside a planned city. You know, there's a city laid out on a grid system, and the university sitting, you know, alongside it. And his comment was that the last thing you wanted was for the university to reflect what the city was, you know, to be a grid structure. And he think he compared it to a medieval town.
Yeah.
He said the university campus is more like a medieval town than a grid structured city. In that every time you walk around a corner, you get a surprise because you're not actually going where you thought you were going, sort of thing. And he said that's
and encouraging different spaces too, not just the sort of Napoleonic sort of.
That's right. You walk around the corner, there's something new there, and it wasn't what you expected, and it's maybe not going in the direction you thought it was going in. And so that was the sort of charm of the campus, which I think is true.
So what we did was we looked at the professions as a whole, and the professions faculty had been quite scattered in, I think, 7 locations, obviously architecture, law, economics in a different place, commerce in a different place, the business school in a different place, and the dean of the faculty, because they couldn't be with the rest of the faculty, decided to be in a different place again.
Never fitted in any Hughes
building.
Space, yeah.
And so there was no cohesion to the faculty, and particularly the commerce, economics, business components. And so we looked around, we did a major study of this campus and said, well, where could we actually start to create the new precinct for the professions? Meanwhile, we had obviously 10 Pulteney Street almost completely externally tenanted.
We owned it, but it was rented out.
Yeah, because nobody knew what to do with the thing. And that was actually part of the business case, was that when it was bought 20 years before, that it would essentially pay for itself. And we had a lot of administrative staff on this campus, and so we really asked the hard question, who needs to be on this campus and who has priority in it? We said quite clearly it was research and teaching and student-facing services that would be on this campus. So we moved 1,500 staff off campus, HR, IT, research
branch.
How many
did you say?
1,500.
I keep struggling to get the right number.
This is into buildings in the nearby CBD.
That's right, yeah.
Brantrell Street.
And cleared 10 Pulteney of the external tenants, and then began that major rejuvenation project. Now, at the time we did that, we said to the faculty, look, there's an opportunity here also for you to consider some change within as well around the structures of business, commerce, and economics, and whether there's some greater integration of those schools, and indeed an opportunity for a greater integration of the way that you service your students. And I don't Well, they didn't get it at first, but they certainly got it within probably 12 months.
And after they'd thought about it and worked on it for a wee while, they realised what the game was about here.
So interestingly, they merged commerce and business into the business school, something which had been literally impossible in the previous years. And it was partly that the opportunity of the new building and the co-location, it just sort of fell out that way. But also building our first student hub there, I think, was a great example of how they brought services into a core from the schools and now have it's a thriving hub serving hundreds and hundreds of or thousands of students.
I mean, the student hubs are the concept that is now appearing, and I mean, they have kind of crept into existence in a sense. We've got one over there and they're starting to appear around the campus, but over the next number of years they're going to be the big development on campus, or one of the big developments on campus. And I think they are, if you sit back and think about it, they make sense. Whenever we were students, there were only a few thousand students at the university. So everybody went to the Union, and that's where you met, and that's where everything happened. Now with 20-odd thousand students on campus, that's not what students want to do. It's all too anonymous. What they want is a hub where they can sit down, they can talk with their friends, they can work on their computers, they can have discussion groups, they can get coffee, something to eat, that is in the locale where their particular faculty is or their particular area of work is. And so instead of having like one location in the campus where you expect 23,000 students to go, you'll end up with six or eight where you'll still have several thousand students going. It's just that the university now is huge in comparison with what it used to be.
And the second building, just to complete that middle period, was the engineering building. And that was based on a review of a hard-headed review of the buildings on campus and which ones were really serving the purpose of the university. And the maths building had a number of, I suppose, attributes that meant that it was not using the development capacity of its footprint, because being in the centre of campus, it can be six, seven stories high, and it was only two.
And it was a cheaply built building.
It was built post-war as a concrete sort of block, and then it was later clad with bricks
when
bricks became available. But it was solid, but not particularly functional. There was a large backlog maintenance bill associated with it, and that part of the campus is probably our most highly valued dirt.
Yeah, and I mean that's a beautiful part of the campus, that. Looking up towards from Frome Road, looking up towards the reading room, or standing in the reading room, looking down, very soon looking right down into the Botanic Gardens, and I have to say, you know, there were some good decisions made. I mean, we make it sound as though nothing had been done in the past, and in fairness, I mean, there were some good decisions made, like to sustain that avenue that looks down to Frome Road.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that...
Take out that building that blocked the end, build the buildings that are there, the Molecular Biosciences and the Santos building, so that they run parallel and sort of give you that sort of avenue effect leading up to the library. And they also built them in red brick, which was consistent with that lower part of the campus, but not an especially imaginative. You know, it was reflective of the style, but it wasn't adding a lot to the architectural merit of the campus. It was just not offending the architectural merit, I thought. But in that sense, I think there'd been some good work done, and we were able then to say, well, now there is a sensible plan here. If we're careful, you can end up with an area that will just be beautiful in the future. It'll just be the most gorgeous area of the campus. And that's what the new Innova building is.
And I think the other aspect of the Innova building was we're very clear now, if we're going to build a building, we will build it to use the development capacity, because we need essentially to upscale the campus.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've looked back at the historical records on the way people have viewed this campus, and part of the reason I understand for Flinders University being created was that this campus was seen as being full. That's within a development style of two stories, two or three stories. If you say, well, look, and we did this study, if you took the buildings that were poorer quality, and I'm certainly not talking about the Bonython's or the Elders or the Mitchells, or am I really talking about the Jordans and the Johnsons and the?
Yeah.
I'm talking about the ones in the middle. And you actually use the capacity which the development plan allows in a completely complying development, but sympathetic to what's around it, and don't build on the green space.
That's the other I was going to mention, that because that's the two issues. One is maximise your footprint,
yep.
maximise the use of the footprint, and don't compromise your open spaces.
And we show that the campus could certainly keep growing. Mm-hmm. And so the Nova building was, an example of that. And I think the other thing we did there was to go the extra step and go for the sustainability angle as well. And
yeah.
So it's just, as you know, recently been awarded the 6 stars.
Yeah. You build a modern building that is of its era, of the time, and the time at the moment is about energy use, it's about the efficiency of the building, it's about the impact the building makes on the environment, etc. And so, especially given that it's engineering that's going in there.
And then the third development, which partly came from that, some of those discussions around urban space and space between buildings and discussions with Jan Gale about where's the heart of the campus, where's the people talk for many years about the front door of the campus, and there are weird and wonderful schemes of things on being built on the side of Mitchell Building or in the middle of the Goodman Crescent or whatever. And that's out of those discussions and thoughts really came the Learning Hub project for Hughes Plaza.
Yeah.
And when we actually took the scales fell from our eyes in some ways and stopped looking at that space from the point of view of the functional units that were surrounding it. It's the back door of the library, the back door of psychology, the back door of the staff club, the back door of computer science, and actually said, forget for a minute who's actually in there. What is that space? How connected is it? Where does it lead? Where do people, where are the pedestrian flows? It's the highest pedestrian flow area, well, not at the moment, but the highest pedestrian flow of the campus. There are two of our major lecture theatres in there. Obviously, the whole Horace Lamb suite is off there. The library. There's connections at level 3. There's connections at level 4. There's connections between Hughes Library through between Horace Lamb. So it actually.
And there can be a connection directly to engineering, and there will be sometime in the future.
We've built a potential for that as well.
But a bridge, just put a bridge straight across into engineering.
Cool. So it really sold itself as a natural place. And I know other universities do similar studies and try and create that level of energy and connection. But
we're fortunate because the size and shape of the campus has allowed us to do it.
Well, it's pivoted around. I mean, you've got the orthogonal.
That was going to be my next place.
You've got the orthogonal sandstone all leading there, and then you've got the river. Whatever they call that, not orthogonal, but the sweep, and it all comes to this central axis, which is the Hughes Plaza. And
it's interesting. I mean, the campus creates problems for us, but at the same time, it gives us opportunities. And there are other universities that would kind of die to have a campus like this. And some of them that might have had campuses like this have done things to them that have kind of compromised them. They've gone for a different style at some time in the past. Like they've decided they want a grand avenue or something. So you end up with all your buildings strung out far apart.
That's UNSW.
UNSW is an example. But here, because we are constrained. We've got the campus and that's it. There's parkland on one side. There's city centre on the other where you can go, but it's expensive to go. And the art gallery like is out there, 6 metres from where we're sitting, etc. So it's created a really compact campus, hence the medieval town illusion.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That could well have been the Mitchell Building. The foundations were down for the first part of that. The government couldn't afford to put the art gallery, the original gallery, on the top.
Really?
And it was mooted as being the first university building.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't realise that.
Don't tell the Vice Chancellor that, because he sees every lost bit of dirt as being a crime.
every missed opportunity is a crime. We should try to repatriate it.
We do. I must admit, when we drive past the City East of UniSA, Yeah. My son asked me, why is that? Why is that so close to the university?
That's
I said, don't ask.
It is a long story, but I mean, I think it's actually an interesting comparison because, I mean, they just had this little block there and it probably wasn't all that core to the university. They just built on it. And I think it's an example of how we could have ended up here, if we weren't very careful, which is to say you've got an area that is just completely covered in concrete and buildings. Mm. And, I mean, I think it's awful because there's no space, And it just there's nothing around it to let the area breathe, and it's one of the reasons why I think we've been so adamant. Certainly, I have, Paul, sometimes I suspect things that get a bit over the top on it. But the open spaces between the buildings, I think those open spaces, the lawns, whether it's the Bar Smith one or those open spaces, I think they are every bit as important as, say, the major buildings like the one we're sitting in. I think they're all gems that we do need to protect. Mm. And the idea that somebody might have built a building on the Goodman Lawns, I mean, I think it's a shocker of an idea. And whenever you see the way it's used now by students and such like, now we've got the cars off it and it's actually an area you can use, I think you can actually see the advantages of those open spaces. Go down to the Bar Smith Lawn almost any lunchtime. There's student activities all over it, whether it's the Greek community's barbecue or whatever it is. I mean, there's every day there's just hiving activities in those spaces. I think they're enormously valuable to us. I don't know how I got onto open spaces, but I think the open spaces. I think the open spaces are valuable, but because we're so constrained, the temptation always is to build something on one of them. You know,
well, it is the path of least resistance. Mm. You know, knocking a building down is. Mm. You know, there's always a group of stakeholders, quite right, you know, quite reasonably, who have an affinity for it. And the mass building is a great example. Yeah. And there was a significant emotional impact on those staff that moved. And
so in the present, there's the learning hub development on what was Hughes Plaza.
Yeah.
Where to from here in the big picture in your minds? How do you preserve the character of what was and yet provide for the future at the same time?
I think that's not all that difficult in the sense that what you do is you try to maximise what you can do on this campus. And I think you have to sort of build in the constraints that you're not going to spoil the appearance, you're not going to spoil the utility of it in terms of the open spaces, etc. You try to take the pressure off by keeping the non-essential people, say, across the street. And then we also then look just to expand into space across the street. We've already got 10 Pulteney, it's there, we own it. We own a block that runs out towards Frome Road. And there are some activities, for example, the dental school needs rebuilding. We don't even own the building it's in. But where would you build a new dental school? Well, not on this campus, clearly. And because it is such a standalone activity and it's medically related, you could put it pretty much on the corner of Frome Road. So there are activities that, as long as you keep them reasonably coherent, you can have spill over the other side of the street. It's just a pity North Terrace is a motorway. It would be better if it was a lane, but unfortunately it's a motorway. What is it they say, 70% of the traffic on North Terrace isn't stopping in the city? Mm. How could be going through?
Mm. Arguably one of the problems with the way that light laid out the city, and it all collects on the north, south, east, west corners. And,
yeah. And well, that's a military survey. Mm.
It is.
And it wasn't thought about automobiles were being thought of.
No, to be fair.
Cannons were, but automobiles weren't.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think we've got that opportunity. I think the prime thing is not to spoil this campus, but to get the maximum out of it and to try and keep as many of our students interacting in this space as we can. And with the hospital moving, there's the prospect of being able to use some of those buildings, so it means we're not quite as hemmed in as maybe we traditionally have been. If we can get access into some of those, you can then see the campus really become a larger footprint, but still looking to preserve that feel and touch that is the campus. I mean, there is something special about this campus. When you go around all sorts of universities, this one is really quite different. There are lots of city centre campuses, lots of city centre universities, but not many that actually have a coherent campus. And I think the challenge for us is to keep the campus coherent as the university grows. And the hospital space would be a huge benefit in doing that. And being able to move across the street for some of our activities. And as Paul says, we've got 1,500 staff currently across there. And if we can keep those people in a coherent relationship with the traditional campus, I think you can do that.
I think the other thing is that if you look at the trying to build up the scale of the campus, I don't think that it's what we're trying to do is sort of overdevelop or make it into a concrete jungle. I think people's expectations of being proximate to disciplines they might have cross-disciplinary connections with, I think people's expectations of proximity actually are that in the olden days of the university, we had the School of Geology had a building, the School of Botany, the School of Chemistry, the School of Physics, and most of the new research is not even between physics and chemistry. It's
in the cracks
between physics and health.
I describe it as being in the cracks. Yeah. All the really exciting stuff's in the space and, between those traditional.
And so I can see how it happened is that you have a sort of a nice two-story neo-Georgian building. This is the School of Geology. You'll have your own lecture theatre, your own tute rooms, the labs and everything completely self-contained. You pop out to the staff club at lunchtime for maybe a bit of interaction. The great example of physics, engineering and health coming together through a whole new platform of photonics and sensing. Those connections are, and we can't predict what they are as well. So we don't want to build buildings for those connections. We want to build buildings that enable whatever the connections might be in the future, which does mean larger floor plates, larger collections of staff in one. And I think people's expectations of that are quite changed now, and that they accept that a 6-7 story building is about right, and a 2-story building is not right. And a lot of the universities that have, I suppose one of the advantages that we've got is not having had so much space, we haven't spread out too far as well. And so I know of some campuses where, I mean, Newcastle's a great example, where it's, it's, or ANU even, it's, lots of two or three story buildings and then 2 kilometres. We've got a density which is actually a good thing, not a, I don't think it's a,
I think it's one of the advantages.
It's a negative.
Not by accident, so to speak. But we do need to watch we don't destroy the advantage, because those interactions, if you move people a few hundred metres apart, those interactions absolutely won't happen. And so it's why we can take, say, the administrative staff and the non-frontline staff and move them across the street without, it causes a few hassles, but you can live with it. But you would not want to put teaching and research disciplines scattered all over Greater Adelaide. You would just lose the benefits of all those interactions.
Now you mentioned, by chance, when you first came, that the fence at the front precluded you even seeing the university, in a sense, you walk right past it. There's a long history of interaction between the wider community and the university as well. Do you think, in a sense, by removing the fence and by keeping the space within the university and the buildings for the continuing needs of research, you've also helped bring the university into the city and the city into the university?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, that was one of the objectives, and if we haven't done that, I think we failed, because I think the fence and that, even if people felt they were interacting, they weren't. There was a sort of a mindset that was saying the university somehow has to maintain its purity. And although we had a long tradition of interacting with the community, those linkages were being a bit tested, perhaps. And I think opening up the frontage has brought a lot of people onto the campus. Now, that's only a first step, then you have to get the interactions taking place. But I would think if we haven't generated that sort of interaction with the city, I mean, we're only here. We only exist. We were built here for a reason. We only exist for a reason, and the reason very simply is that the community, our community, which is Adelaide, wants us to be here. They're willing to pay tax to have us here, and they'll only do that if they perceive that there's some benefit. So just locking ourselves away in a monastic community would not give that, not suggesting they ever did, but there's a danger that you can do that. But maximizing those interactions, I think, is enormously important for the future of the university in terms of how people perceive it.
I think after the North Terrace redevelopment was finished and our the frontage project, as we called it.
And the dust settled.
And the dust settled and the jacaranda started growing and what have you. The very first festival ideas after that, I think it might have been the first festival ideas, was in Elder Hall. And they had the speakers out onto Goodman Crescent. People were sitting out on the on the bits of the seats and whatever that had been laid out and on the lawns. And it was just one of those beautiful Adelaide days as well. And I thought that this is, you know, that this is working. It is seen as being part of the community asset.
I think the North Terrace one is good. I think we have challenges. I think the Victoria Avenue side is unresolved. And if you just gave me a bit of paper and said you can do whatever you like, I would love to resolve that area, because I think we've got now a very busy road in terms of Victoria Avenue, because the way in which the traffic has been reconfigured has caused an enormous number of cars now to drive along Victoria, because you can't turn right on North Terrace, so they have to come along and go up the side streets and things. But if you really could get your way, what I would love to see is a similar opening up down onto the parklands and to the river, so that just opened right up into the university campus and drew people in from the other side and caused them to want to be interfacing through that space, and perhaps coming in from the city and going out into the parkland and vice versa. And to me, that's still a completely unresolved part of the campus. The big fence is still there.
I think that is. I mean, our plan ultimately would be a car-free campus.
Yeah.
And to have once the learning hub's finished, to have Western Drive remodeled, so that is, you know, the sort of grand boulevard if you want, but essentially one that brings people into the campus, goes down to the river, that the Victoria Drive is calmed in some way with traffic, or I mean ideally stopped, but calmed in some way. The cloisters don't have cars parked through there. And so that axis is resolved. Then the axis across the learning hub, over the bridge to your new engineering building and through to medicine, but also coming through the guts of the learning hub down Horace Lamb and out, again that will be resolved. And also, as we've done behind Bonython Hall with the Walter Young Gardens, that continues on down as well. So we actually have a well-connected campus. I think that's critical.
And I think there is an opportunity to do that coming up with the movement of the hospital. There's a big new car park that the hospital uses, and that could be used to take a lot of the cars that currently clutter Victoria Drive, park, because they're parked all day, most of them down there, park them over there, get Victoria Drive, as Paul describes it, calmed, so that we can then open it up, we can get the cars off the campus, you can extend the Barsmith lawn down towards the river, not have cars parked along the interface between it and the river, and really turn that side of the campus into something beautiful and functional.
So is there anything that you would both or I would like to conclude with in terms of what we've been talking about? Or do you think what you've just said would sum up pretty much where the place could go in the future?
Look, one of the things that also is at the aim of the Learning Hub is that Union House, in its location, that essentially the centre of gravity of the campus has moved from that, and you know, we've done surveys of students and Rundle Mall's a huge attraction, Rundle Street's a huge attraction. There's, you know, there's Hawker areas over on the other side of North Terrace. And so what we've found over time is that our students aren't spending as much time on campus. And so we're keen to provide, through the Learning Hub project and associated satellite learning hubs, spaces where the students do want to
actually counterwit
be part
to
of
try and keep them
yeah
warm.
Be part of campus mm-hmm. life. And so building in not just you know, student services, not just places to sit, but also library learning services and you know food options as well, means that we can create that centre of gravity back in the campus. And so people actually see being part of Adelaide University and being part of the campus life as being important.
I think what I would say about it is that it's important to remember that although the campus has got a lot of heritage value, that it's a working dynamic entity, and that if we want to keep it looking, as you go into the future, keep it looking valuable in a heritage sense, that requires constant work. And I think there's almost been a perception at times in the past that you do that by freezing it in time and saying, we have a lovely campus, we'll just, that's it, we'll freeze it. Don't touch anything, it's frozen.
And put a coffee shop in there and have weddings in there.
Yeah.
And which is what everyone does with heritage buildings.
Yeah. And
I don't know what to do.
I think that's absolutely the wrong thing for a university. I think what we need to be doing is constantly racking our brains thinking, how do we improve this for the future? And in another institution some years ago, we were at the university, we were doing some building on a new campus. And I remember saying to the architects, we're talking about what sort of building we wanted. I said, I want a building that's built for 200 years. And they said, nobody builds a building for 200 years. I said, we do. They said, no, you build a building for 40 years. And you know, that's kind of it. I said, no, this is a university. You want to think in time frames that are 200 years out. And what we want to do is to think about the fact that this campus, it will be here in 200 years. How do we make sure that in 200 years it is still a dynamic, functioning, beautiful university campus? And I think that's the real challenge for us. So that the changes we make, the ANOVA building coming on stream, I would imagine that's a new engineering building. I would imagine that building, you know, in 50 years' time, people will be coming and looking at it and saying, that's what you could do in 2010. That was what was possible then. And people will be proud of the fact that there are features in there that have become every day or you know, been improved on or whatever. And as we go forward, if we keep improving each building, each space, the way in which we use it, the way in which we interface, then in 100 and 200 years' time, the campus is going to be an absolute icon.
Mm. Look, I think even this building, the Mitchell building that we're in today, and our decisions around that, I think are also part of that, which is from time to time we've thought about, you know, what's the purpose of the building? Should we move out? The offices aren't very modern, etc. And every time we think about it, we say,
no.
This building was the original home of the university. To have the Vice-Chancellor in here, to have it a place where people can come and interact with the Vice Chancellor in a prestigious setting is what it's about, and it is a living building. There is a use for it. There is a future, and I think you know the temptation is to move out of the heritage buildings, and then if they don't have a use, no one's going to keep pouring money into them. They've actually got to have a function.
You have to make
meets
sure that people want to use them. And the Elder Hall's a good example, you know, of a building that came near to extinction. But now, you know, it is just used constantly. It's just there is a demand and a use, and the community's in it all the time, and there's teaching going on in it. It's just phenomenally useful to the university. I think there's some real challenges. I mean, we have to be careful but brave. And that's a combination that's a bit hard to...
So is there anything else that you feel you'd like to add before we conclude?
No, I think the only thing that is easy to forget whenever we sit on the North Terrace campus is that this is only one of the university's campuses, and that there are other campuses, and the two at Roseworthy and at the Waite are also iconic campuses. And everything we do is a competition for money. It's a competition for capital. So whenever we do something here, it's competing with the vet school at Roseworthy. It's competing with the plant accelerator at Waite. So there's always, it's not a case of if the university can borrow some money and they can do something here. It's a case of deciding where we would be best to do these things. And in the future, I think that, I mean, we've got a campus up in Singapore, small campus, but nevertheless it's there. Now, we haven't put any capital into that, which is a decision we made. But I think there is going to be that ongoing competition for capital, and we have to think about the whole university, and then this is really the core of the university, but it is one of the modules that is the university.
I don't know, Rob, if you want to have a coda in your book about Union Hall at the time of writing, dot, dot, dot.
I'm actually hoping we might not deal with that.
Okay.
Is it a rightful?
Of course, no, of course. Yeah.
I mean, I think it'll be interesting to...
It's the unknown, isn't it?
Well, I think the arguments we've just been talking about and the themes we've been talking about are, it's a... Yeah.
And I think
it's right at the crossroads of that.
That's going to be one that in 10 years' time you're going to look at and say, right, what happened and what was it all about and... Mm. Have we done the right thing?
Oh, of course. Mm.
And we obviously believe what we're trying to do is the right thing. Mm. Other parties believe the same.
Yeah, I actually think that example, if you're not being silly and saying that could be a concluding point, because in a sense it's the tensions that any university in a city is on about.
Yeah, they are.
You're trying to provide a service for students and for research, and at the same time there's that sense of the people outside the campus that they also have an ownership of it.
They do. Yeah. And, I mean, we have to remember that, and they also have to recognise that this is a living, dynamic, modern university, and we can't just freeze. We can't just say, okay, everything's frozen, because if it's frozen, it's of no use. Mm. By 10 years' time, we'll be a second, third-rate university, and that's it. Or we'll have moved.
Is that okay to finish it
there? Yeah, sure. I think so.